Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. So there's this vexing question about, can taxing the rich fix the budget deficit in the United States? And as Bernie Sanders and AOC make their way around the country on their Tax the Rich tour, I came across this article that was written by an economist from the Manhattan Institute that is in captions, here's what would happen if we seized all the wealth from America's 800 billionaires, and what would happen. Joining us is Patrick Button, associate professor of economics at Tulane University. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Patrick, I found this article somewhat intriguing about if we just stripped away everything they have, what would it actually mean? And this economist says it wouldn't mean much as it relates to dealing with the deficits that we're racking up with the U.S. budget. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I mostly agree with you there. I think the problem is pretty severe. So to give the larger picture, the deficit right now is about $1.8 trillion. So that means that the government, federal government, spends more than $1.8 trillion more than it brings in. And if we compare the current debt that we have to our gross domestic product, which is the amount of, you know, action in the economy, the debt to GDP ratio is 123%. So if the federal government and the entire country were to like put all of its money towards the debt, it would take us 1 year and 3 months to try to pay off the entire debt that we have. So it's a pretty big issue that we're facing right now. So it's absolutely the case that all these proposals would not, you know, solve this issue. And I don't think most people agree that that's the case. It will help a lot, but we need to do a lot of different things, both cutting expenditures, cutting spending, and also increasing taxes in order to wrestle with this big deficit problem.
So the author of the article says if you took everything from the 800 billionaires, it's not going to eliminate it. In fact, it would only finance the federal government for 9 months for 1 year, not 9 months out of every year. So it's a one-time deal, right? And then they're gone. And if you took 100% of the marginal tax rates for millionaires in the country, it doesn't do a whole lot more because there just simply aren't that many, right?
Yeah. So from the same article from Manhattan Institute, if we were to enact all of these different sort of broadly tax-rich proposals that could be increasing top income tax brackets, that could be increasing capital gains, closing tax loopholes, raising corporate tax rates, you know, if we were to do all those things, that would at best provide 2% of the GDP in terms of tax revenue, right? That would make a significant dent in the debt-to-GDP ratio, but it would not solve the entire thing. So I think that it still is a lot of money that could be extremely useful. And absolutely, the only way we can resolve this would be to do some of these proposals, but there's no way that they're going to resolve the entire problem.
But isn't one of the problems, and I think, you know, as I listened the other day to a presentation put on by Bernie Sanders and AOC, they never talk about what downstream implications or negative implications are when you begin to raise tax rates on individuals, you know, who are otherwise nimble and can pretty much go wherever they want, and they will, in order to shelter as much of their income as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's sort of missing from a lot of these, you know, stump speeches and whatnot, is sort of what is what we call distortionary effect of taxes, right? And it depends on the tax. That's why we have to be strategic about which taxes do we want to cut, which taxes do we want to raise. For example, corporate tax rates can really affect investment behavior. And so some economists are more wary of increasing corporate taxes. However, one proposal to increase taxes, which doesn't have as much of a negative effect, would be to raise income taxes, especially at top income brackets, where workability is sort of less sensitive to the income tax rate. So every tax is discretionary. It just sort of depends on how much. And so we have to dig into the details.
When we talk about In the article, there's a breakdown of American taxes are highly progressive. Your thoughts about what was laid out in that section, and if you would, explain that for the listening audience.
Yeah, that's great. So progressive taxes means, and most countries have progressive taxes, that means that, for example, there's higher income tax rates for those who have higher incomes. So you may face a marginal higher income tax rate, so maybe you're paying 30% in taxes if you have very high incomes compared to 10% in taxes, or even you're actually getting tax credits at lower income. So every country has that. United States is fairly typical. I'd say one difference is that for the better or for worse, I think maybe for better, United States actually has very low tax rates for very low incomes. So families sort of near the poverty line oftentimes pay little taxes, or sometimes they get tax credits, such as the earned income tax credit, which is used to sort of reduce poverty and encourage work. So that's why, you know, the article talks about the U.S. having a more progressive system. That's because the tax rates at the very lowest rungs of the economic ladder are very low, which I think is probably good for reducing poverty.
So when you settle that, and what, you know, again, and a lot of people don't really understand how much of this actually goes to financing a government. I love when they break it down and they said the top earn 20% actually fund government for 201 days out of the 365. The next 20% fund 41 days. And the bottom earning 60% of Americans, which means the U.S. population, including the median earners, funded the federal government for just 21 days of the year. So the sum total of what they pay, it covers 21 days of expenses of the federal government. And it kind of lays it out where you see who's predominantly funding and financing government today, right?
Right, absolutely. So I think it's absolutely the case that those with higher incomes are absolutely paying more. I don't think that's under question whatsoever. But we have to kind of think strategically about, you know, those questions of fairness. There's a question of impacts, right? So if we were to increase taxes on lower income families, that's going to have more of an impact than, say, those at higher income families. And certainly those higher income families are paying proportionately more, right? But I think we have to kind of keep in account, like, how taxes indirectly affect each type of family, I think, is sort of one of the larger things that are here. And so there's no sort of winning strategy, but I think we have to be really careful about thinking about who's going to be most impacted by taxes if we were to raise those, or who's going to be most impacted by spending cuts or spending increases.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
So when we compare ourselves to European countries, right, and AOC and Bernie have been doing this as well, but they only give really half the picture. I was just in Croatia at the beginning of the summer. They had, like, I think it was a 23% value-added tax, a sales tax, a national sales tax. And, you know, you have some national sales taxes that are as high as 27, 30% in some European countries, but they don't talk about that at all, and that's why, you know, they're able to fund and finance some of the social programs that they have, whether it's medicine, this, that, or otherwise, because they had this whole other tax. And by the way, that other tax is not progressive, right? It's regressive.
It's progressive, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's funny because sales taxes aren't really discussed much in any of these proposals, probably because I think there is a hesitancy to use those because they are really regressive, meaning that those with lower incomes are paying more of that. So, you know, if you're, you know, you have to pay, you know, 5% tax on every single purchase you make, you know, at a grocery store, like that adds up more for lower income families. And so there's some hesitancy to use that tax because it's so aggressive.
And the interesting thing is that those value added taxes in those countries are providing a significant percentage of GDP with those. And a lot of those countries are a lot like New Orleans, right? They're heavily reliant on tourism. In fact, in Croatia, the number one industry in Croatia is tourism. And, you know, the number one generator of income for the government is that value-added tax. you know, and then in within the cities, there's an additional 2 or 3%. I think they try to make sure that they all stay below 5%, but you could be paying as much as 26% in value added tax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think generally in Europe, there's more of that value added tax, but then there's also tends to be one compensating mechanism, which is sort of more of a social welfare system that would then provide additional income to those families that are disproportionately paying more of that tax, right? So typically when you increase those taxes, you have to think about what are ways that we can minimize the impact on lower income families. And so European countries generally tend to have more of those policies that would compensate some of the regressive impacts of that tax.
Yeah, but, you know, I think the point you're making, they highlight the benefit that they're getting, but they're not highlighting how much they're actually paying in VAT tax in order to be able to enjoy that benefit.
And, right. Certainly the narrative is not complete whatsoever. I mean, people aren't like talking like that's what we're trying to get into the weeds of it. People are sort of talking about, oh, generally it's going to raise a bunch of money and there's not as much discussion about how or exactly how much. Right. And so that's why we have to fill in the details.
Yeah, I just find it very misleading because, you know, I have people ask me because I was the former tax collector in Jefferson Parish. And they're like, well, this is how it happens in Europe. And I'm like, no, that's not how it happens in Europe. So they're paying your middle income wage earners and your lower income wage earners, because of the regressive nature of the value added tax, they're paying a much larger proportion of taxes than in the United States. They get benefits, yes, but they're paying for them in one way or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a lot of details missing. I think, you know, to get a handle on this deficit issue, this debt issue, you know, I think it requires a lot of strategies around, you know, increasing tax revenue and decreasing expenditures. And that's where you have to get into the nitty gritty of what are we spending on what. Like, for example, we spend the same amount on Medicare as we do a national defense, which is $874 billion, just as an example, right? And so we have to have these difficult questions about, like, which tax levers do we move up and down, you know, which spending levers we move up and down. And it's kind of hard to communicate all of that if you're doing just some speech.
I think Clinton was the last president to balance the budget. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, I just looked at that. Yeah, because we saw the deficit really explode starting about 2001, which is the dot-com bubble recession. So after 2001 onwards, we've seen, under all presidents, generally speaking, the deficit growing. So, yeah, you're exactly right.
And, you know, when we think about a clip of 1.4 to 1.8 trillion a year that we're adding, you know, whatever that number is, and they're saying that, you know, based on some calculations that are coming up, it could get as high as 3.4 trillion. We don't really, I mean, even with all the proposals, we would have to get to crazy, crazy tax rates to turn the tide if we're going to be above $3 trillion. That we're adding to the deficit every year.
Yeah, so definitely tax reform is not going to solve this issue. So increasing taxes is not going to fully resolve this issue. It's going to be something that we chip away at the long term, both with increasing tax revenue and then also decreasing expenditures. So both things have to happen.
And then when we think about how much of the budget is just tied up with defense, Medicare, Medicaid?
Yeah, so So Medicare, just Medicare on its own, not like Medicaid or other health programs, is $874 billion, which is the same amount of spending for national defense. The largest expenditure is Social Security, so it's going to be retirement benefit, disability insurance. That's $1.4 trillion. Second big expenditure is health, not including Medicaid, including Medicaid, children's health insurance program, Center for Disease Control, NIH, things like that, is just under $1 trillion. So there's quite a few, you know, like large pockets of expenditure that would have to be looked at. And that's where we have to be really strategic about, like, what do we value as a nation? You know, cutting things is not great, right? But, like, what are the things that are sort of less crucial, right?
Yeah. So can it be done?
That's a great question. I mean, it's a pretty big issue. I think we did see significant progress on this, you know, during Clinton and sort of prior presidents, right? I'm hoping that we can sort of at least try to, you know, decrease the trend, because if we keep increasing the deficit, increase increasing the debt, which is what we're seeing of the current president and previous president happen to, then we're going to be paying more and more in what we call net interest. So the third largest expenditure for the federal government is net interest. So we pay $880 billion of interest payments on our debt. So it's the third largest expenditure, just a little bit more than we spend on Medicare, a little bit more than we spend on national defense. And so that amount that we pay is going to keep growing unless we try to shrink that. But I think, you know, if we can think strategically, we can try to shrink that gradually. But yeah, I can't tell if that's something that we can resolve. I think with the current political climate, I'm skeptical.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, that the old adage that the federal government can just print money. Yes, it can, but it's at a cost, right? It's not.
Absolutely.
It's not free.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people out there that think it's just free. It's not.
I wish it were that simple.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Patrick Button, Associate Professor of Economics at Tulane University. Truly appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Open Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Breaking news. Southern University campus placed on lockdown. Students told to shelter in place. We'll try to get more information for you when we return.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.